make sure to give my dad a 5-star review.
Make sure to like and subscribe to his YouTube. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the show.
Assassinations evolved. It's no longer about the ending of life, because what's one of the famous terms that we use today? Character assassination, right? So we are effectively getting the means that we want by silencing voices or silencing individuals by doing what we call character assassinations or cancel culture. So you're still seeing it today. You're just seeing the evolution of it, and you're seeing other techniques in order to employ it. So as in the human condition, we got smarter and said, hey, we don't have to end a life in order to affect those means. We just got to do X, Y, or Z.
Hey, welcome everybody, our faithful politics listeners and viewers. We are continuing our March for Life series, and we are actually finishing it with our very last one. But before we do that, just quick introductions. I am Will Wright. I am your political host, and I'm joined by my ever faithful host, Josh, the man, the legend, Bertram.
I like how you did that. Faithful.
Yes, I'm all about
that's very biblical of you.
Yeah, faithful squared. And we're joined by a person
who can kill you in a second.
Yes, his name is Master Sergeant Juan Mata. He is the CEO and principal subject matter expert of Quiet Pro Tactical. He is a former Green Beret combat veteran. He's got numerous combat deployments, including Iraq and Afghanistan. His qualifications include Special Forces, Advanced Urban Combat Course, Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape, Tactical Combat Casualty Care, Special Operations Terminal Attack Controller, Technical Surveillance, Counter Surveillance, and U.S. Army Ranger School, and Lover of the Whoopi. Nice. So welcome, Matt. Welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah. You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So we wanted to bring you on to talk to you about war and assassinations. And I'm assuming that you probably know a thing or three about that particular topic. But before we do that, I have to ask you a somewhat military related question. So Steve Rogers, he entered the army as a private, E1. Steve Rogers, as you guys all know, is Captain America. Then he got this like super soldier COVID vaccine, and then he was automatically promoted to an O3, a captain, Captain America, from E1 to O3. So my question is, like, do you feel that white enlisted personnel have an unfair advantage to become commissioned officers in the Army?
Will, I'm going to take the politically correct answer and say that courage is colorblind. So when we found that courage in E1 Private Rogers, and we didn't see an accurate time lapse in the movie Marvel, but, you know, World War II was an extended period of time, so that's the unknown there. We don't know the amount of time that passed in between, you know, collecting them for that character and promotion to O3.
That is a very good and unexpected response. I'm proud of you, Mata. I'm proud of you.
This is what I do. I tap dance.
That's good.
Answer the question you want to answer, not the one that you're asked.
Yes,
that's the key to politics. Yes. No, but more seriously. So you're a Green Beret. So like, can you tell our audience what a Green Beret is, and like how does a person become a Green Beret? I mean, is that like just something you can sign up for, and then they give you like a beret that's colored green, or is there like more to it?
It's an all-inclusive group, U.S. Army Special Forces. So we take everybody that wants to come, and we selected the color green for our beret because we felt that it most represented everyone, all colors on the spectrum. So I'm just kidding. Actually, that's not it at all.
I was going with it.
If you take a rainbow and you put it together, it becomes green.
Yeah, no. To be honest with you, I was very fortunate to serve in that unit. We pride ourselves on being a specially selected and well-trained group of individuals. Because of that, our mission set is very wide and very broad, and we are utilized in all different manners that the general public doesn't understand. One of the biggest case in points is deterrence. You think that we are probably the best at violence, but we're probably the best at deterring violence all around the world. So that's essentially kind of just scratch the surface what a Green Beret does.
Yeah, but like, what's the process? I mean, like, obviously you have to be in the military, like, I think, right? You can't just be like a civilian that comes off the street. So like, do you have to go through some sort of training? Is there like a selection process, or like, what's so kind of the
process that I took was I enlisted into the military. So right off the bat, you have to have certain medical qualifications, or you can't be disqualified medically with certain conditions, right? So you have to be healthy, able-bodied. You have to be very physical fit. There's a lot of our selection process covers that, your physical fitness capability. And then along with that, it's a huge mental stressor. So you do partake in some pretty challenging and daunting physical tasks, but it's really to assess who's mentally weak versus mentally strong. Part of that is a IQ, right? So everybody in the Special Forces has to have an IQ above a certain range. And I use the word IQ loosely because it's a different test that we use in the military to kind of gauge those things. So you have to be a little bit smarter than the average person, a little bit stronger than the average person, but your motivation is what we're probably looking for above and beyond. We're looking for self-starters. We're looking for people that don't have to be told, get up in the morning, brush your teeth. We're looking for those people that are able to do those things above and beyond.
What's the pass rate?
What's that?
The pass rate. So like how many people? Yeah.
So it generally fluctuates, but I'd say about 30 to 40% that from the start of Special Forces selection and assessment all the way through graduation of the qualification course. And you know, I kind of hit about some of the requirements that you needed in order just to go to Special Forces assessment and selection. But that is the first step of the process. That's about a month long. And my training took in its entirety about 2 years before I was a qualified Green Beret. So it takes a lot of time and development in order to complete our training.
So what's the worst part of the testing that you can tell us about? Like, what was the most like mentally challenging and emotionally challenging thing that you had to do in training that you're able to disclose?
Good question. I think, for me, it was just the endurance of it. It's because when you're 2 years under a microscope, you're being evaluated by every man you could possibly imagine. It just gets mentally tiring, right? And we have this little phrase, hey, this is a marathon, it's not a sprint. So well, you could go out and you could be the best person for a couple of weeks. That person is going to tire out and the true character is going to come out after that. So you have to have a mental endurance capability in order to survive that training for that long.
Now, Mark Twain, he once said God created war so that Americans, you know, would learn geography. I think there's probably some truth to that, but, and I'm sure that you traveled to some pretty exotic places. Did you ever go anywhere, or be involved in an operation that you thought was unnecessary?
No, never. To go back to what you originally said, Mark, what Mark said, that is very true, because in U.S. Army Special Forces, we are in so many corners of the globe that I had no idea existed, right? So you do your country studying, you do research, and you're like, wow, where is this place? Where does it border? Why am I being sent there? And there's always that big why, right? And to answer your question, what was I ever in a location that I didn't feel was necessary? It was most likely no, because we were given the why. We were given the intent of what our mission was, and that helps us accomplish that mission. So, like I said, a lot of what we do is deterrence. A lot of what we do is stabilization, partner force building. So there's a lot of needy people in the world, and we feel that we had services that helped them either maintain what they have, grow a certain capability, or you know, continue in their quest for freedom or security or whatever the case may be.
Yeah. So when you say deterrence, like, so one thing that's coming to my head is like, like the common argument, of course, for like large defense spending and the kind of training that you have to go through is that we need the best military in the world. We need the best people in the world. And basically we have to have force so that we can like force is going to enable like other people to be free. Like no one's just gonna like, no dictator is just going to step down because we asked them nicely. So like there has to be some kind of force behind it. And what kind of deterrence are we talking about that you're able to, like, what's the nature of that deterrence that you can tell us about on a podcast? And why do you think it works?
Let's keep things as people have the tendency to try to convolute and look for things that strengthen their position. And it's so much simpler than that. So I talk about deterrence on a grand scheme of things, or strategically, we could say, hey, we're deterring our adversaries such as Russia, China, North Korea, or whatever from coming into these spaces and trying to set up some of their ideologies, which could be a factor and could be a reason why we're in country X. But a lot of it, too, is just the instability that we see in large parts of the world, i.e. Africa, right? So just a few weeks ago, 220-something females were kidnapped from a school. Those things don't happen when you have people ready to do violence on their part. So a good, bad, or indifferent, right, when you see a large, strong man, or, you know, I'm using the term man here, but a long, strong person, they're ready to keep acts from happening. Most of those criminal organizations, they take the path of least resistance and say, hey, I'm not going to go here. I'm going to go to that other school, which is not protected in this other region of the world that doesn't have Green Berets or whatever the case is, right? So while we think about Green Berets on a strategic level, it is also very, very simple.
But how do you, how do you decide, you know, like, and I know that necessarily maybe like you yourself personally don't decide, but I'm thinking more broadly, like how does the country decide what areas are best to, you know, have a presence? And maybe, you know, added on to that question is, you know, how much does politics play into the decision to occupy an area?
Right.
So that's the beauty of it. And that's what I wish my message to the American people was this. It was, you have a overwhelming majority of good people in organizations, for example, the intelligence community. Like, who's going to say the intelligence community is filled with great people? Like, nobody's willing to stand and do that. But I'm here to say, like, it comes from the bottom. There's people are gathering information and they're collecting data and actual intelligence, and then they're sending that up to their supervisors that take that up the political chain, right? And then they're like, hey, these events are happening in this region, and it either goes with your political beliefs and what you stand for and what you campaign for, or it doesn't. So it's something that I want to bring to everybody's attention. That's how politics could influence some of the things that we see on the ground. I think in special operations.
So both. Unique. So go ahead.
I think one of the reasons why I'm so interested in politics and policy of the nation is because we're the ones that see it first in special operations. We are the organization that could go implement those policies first. So that's why I'm always kind of gathering information and trying to collect data to see where the boss wants to go.
So let me ask the $1 million question in one sense. Abraham Lincoln is kind of famous for saying that or thinking that there was, well, maybe he's not famous for this for other reasons, but he, you know, believed that assassinations were actually okay if there is a tyrant or something or someone like that involved. What do you think, like, what justifies violence, or say like an assassination? If we, the $1 million question is it an assassination? Like, when is it justified? Is it justified? And if it is, when? And then the broader question, of course, is, you know, how do we justify in your mind violence, the use of violent force and taking of a life? Like, what's the kind of justification there for us to do that? What do you think?
Man, so when I was, let me back way far up. So I was nervous on to the show. I was nervous coming on the show, right? Because you guys are doing this entire series kind of March for Life, and you're talking about abortions and you're talking about other subjects. And there's a lot of quantitative data and reasons to support your position and things like that. And I'm like,
sure.
Well, these guys are doing an entire March for Life, but then I'm coming on and it's almost as if I'm trying to justify war and death. And so there's not, that, and not
that
only
was
that,
Will's but fault.
a lot of the, you know, there's not a lot of data to quantify. Is an assassination good? Is it necessary? Is it bad? Is it one or the other? And you can't. All you could do is come up with a set of matrices or whatever and say, is this person more lethal or a bigger threat to society dead or alive? And that's the basic calculus on how we approach every operation, right? Not just assassination. It's, we have a very deliberate, very scrutinized intelligence gathering, information gathering process. And we look at each person that we go after in special operations, and we take that calculus. Is the risk worth the reward? right? Is it worth sending our special operations soldiers into these environments in order to take on this risk to kill capture this person, or is it not? And it's not black and white. It is not right or wrong. It ultimately goes to that politician or whoever that leader is to slap the table, make the decision, say, yes, we are going to, try and go this route through assassination in order to meet whatever our objective is.
So the U.S. has actually conducted quite a few assassinations and assassination attempts, you know, so like the CIA's plot to, kill, Fidel Castro and Libya Colonel El Gaddafi. And then also like, most recently Trump and his killing of the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani. I'd be curious to hear your view or opinion on, how beneficial and or detrimental do you think the assassinations are in, modern day warfare?
In modern day warfare, I don't believe that they are as effective as they were touted in history, right? You could always look at examples in history where we were trying to poison a king or a tyrant or do these things, but the idea was that when that tyrant is gone, then those ideas or nobody was going to maintain the capability in order to do those things on. Modern warfare and education and communication has allowed us to bypass a lot of those things that we used to think back in the days, because we know that you can't kill an idea, right? We know that we compartmentalize information now. If you look at the most current insurgencies in ISIS and Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, they compartmentalize all their information and all their operations so that when we do go and try to pluck out, right, or assassinate, if you will, that one character that pops up on the radar, the entire operation or the entire campaign just doesn't die because of it. So while that might be an effective technique in a location, and I'll just use an example like North Korea, right, with the assumption that Kim Jong is the only one capable of running North Korea, and his subjects don't have the education or the capability in order to do, what it is that dictator in country X is doing, then let's go for it. Then that might still be a very viable option. I'll just say that in cases all around the world, that's most likely not the best course of action.
Now we have a listener question from our Facebook group. I put a question out there saying, hey, who wants to ask a Green Beret a question? So one of the questions that was asked was kind of framed more in the sense of assassinations done here in the U.S. And I know, or at least like to think that it wasn't necessarily driven by any sort of military operations, but and even if it was, you probably couldn't talk about it, I'm sure. But like, MLK, Malcolm X, kind of name your civil rights leader or whatever, so the question was, do you think assassination is a tool America still uses as one of its foreign policy tools, and just covers it up better these days, or was it just easier to do like back in the 1960s?
Well, let me back up, and I will say assassinations evolved. It's no longer about the ending of life, because what's one of the famous terms that we use today? Character assassination, right? So we are effectively getting the means that we want by silencing voices or silencing individuals by doing what we call character assassinations or cancel culture. So you're still seeing it today. You're just seeing the evolution of it, and you're seeing other techniques in order to employ it. So
wow.
as in the human condition, we got smarter and said, hey, we don't have to end a life in order to affect those means. We just got to do X, Y, or Z now. And cancel culture is so popular.
Dude, I'm so fascinated by what you said, because I didn't even think about this. So like, what I heard you say is that like some of these cancel culture things or these like character assassinations are likely political in origin, not just like, hey, people are political, but like they're political, like from like a governmental stance, like someone's trying to take this out,
not only take that idea out, but it's a lot tougher for us to find the origin, right? Because through technology, and there are ways to mask where information's coming from. So that idea might spark in a certain location in the United States, but those flames could very well be fanned by our adversaries, right? So I'm telling you, there's teams of people and countries that want nothing more than us to bicker and fight eternally, right? And all they have to do is retweet, repost, build a certain character online that takes that same information and publishes it. So it's a very easy, and it's not something that requires a lot of resources for these countries that are not as strong as us militarily and economically in order to achieve some of the same means, which is just a disruption in the United States.
Wow. You know, that there's a really great podcast that I would recommend you listen to, aside from ours, of course. It's called Winds of Change, and it's this like study about how the CIA basically helped write this song after the Berlin Wall came down. And it goes, I won't give it away, but it goes into detail about like how they worked with the Scorpions to kind of help write the song as a bit of a psyops operation to try to like rally a revolution. So everything you're saying makes perfect sense. And you know, you don't have to assassinate the person. You can just assassinate their idea or their character, and it's just as effective.
So that's unbelievable, man. Oh yes, great point. I want to shift the conversation just a little bit. I mean, it's still we're talking about assassinations and war, and so you know, obviously, morally, you've been understand the necessity of force, and of course, warfare has changed over the years. When's the last time America declared a war, where Congress declared a war? I guess it was the first Iraqi war, when Desert, they actually made a declaration of war.
I think Desert Storm.
Desert Storm. Yeah. So, I mean, it's been decades, right? 30 years almost since we've actually declared a war. And of course, there's been plenty of conflict in that 30-year time. But I guess my question, real quick, first, from a biblical point of view, obviously, when you look at the Old Testament, the Hebrew scriptures, that first 39 books of the Bible, what Christians call the Bible, there's a lot of war. And there's actually an idea of holy war, where God actually sends his people into an area to essentially either drive out or exterminate everyone in the area. Those were kind of the options. They could either, convert to Judaism. They could come under the theocracy that was there, or they basically had to be driven out into exile, or they would die, be killed. And God sent them to do this. I mean, I don't think as Christians we should try to whitewash anything or water down anything. For me, that's clear in the Bible that that's what God did. And so I think looking at that, I think it's the same Bible. I mean, same God between the Old Testament and New Testament. So the same God that sent Jesus, in my mind, is the God who also commanded that the Israelites go and drive out or exterminate the people in the land of Canaan. And that's a whole thing that we can get into that we may not have time today as we're focusing on particularly your experience in modern day. But I for one, am a believer in a just war theory, that the use of force is justified under certain conditions. And I've always just kind of assumed like, hey, you know, more war is morally justified. And I've always assumed that America, we had moral justification for the wars that we've gone into, the use of force and the conflicts that we've entered into. I assumed that growing up. As I grew older, I stopped assuming that as much because we're imperfect. And I would just, you know, and when you get into the Bible, the New Testament, of course, you have Jesus who didn't lead a military campaign against the Romans, who submitted himself to execution by the state, and whose followers for the first 300 years, if you compare Christianity for the first 300 years to essentially almost any other religion, it wasn't a political movement. It wasn't driven by politics and it wasn't driven by force. And actually, they were severely persecuted for the first 300 years intermittently by the state because they became a threat to them. That all changed when Constantine came to power in the fourth century. But my question for you is, as you're, and I have no idea where your faith is. I have no idea how you grew up. So you can talk about that if you want. You don't have to. I have no idea where your belief is. But in terms of, but I know you have a moral compass because you're a person and you have morality. Where in your heart, like, what is the moral justification for the use of force? And how does that, you know, I know that you're supposed to just do, as a Green Beret or as someone in military, you just do whatever they ask you to do. I mean, there's a chain of command and you do it. But having to be involved with it, like, how did that affect your morals? And did you ever find yourself in a moral, like, conundrum or tension about, like, I don't know if this is really moral or not? And maybe you can answer that question, maybe you can't, but I'd love to get your ideas on the morality of war here from a personal experience.
Exactly. And one of the things that I like to do is break things down and make it as simple as possible, because we talk about faith. My faith is Christian. I consider myself Catholic. So I grew up with those guiding principles, right? And oftentimes one of the scriptures that one of the scriptures that always has caused probably some of the most conflict in my life was live by the sword or die by it, right? If you live by the sword, you're going to die by it. So me, as a career military man, living by those life-saving tools, which were, you know, my rifles, my pistols, and all those things, it always created some conflict. Is if I am living by these tools, then I'm going to die by them. There's a lot of truth with that, because I'm always going, you know, always operate in those environments. The likelihood for those events happening goes up, right? But I do what I do because I believe in good. So because I believe in good, I also believe in evil, right? I believe in God. So there is the existence of the devil. There's always going to be a point in time where when you're faced with evil, evil is not going to want to come to the negotiation table with you, or there's going to be a part where evil wants to be evil and evil wants to have their way. So I'm stand ready in order to face evil on the behalf of those that can't. And that's just point blank period what I do and how I justify what I do. And because of my faith, that's also has freed my ability to be the soldier that I want to be on the battlefield, where I am not as timid approaching my own expiration as those around, because as a Christian, I believe that what I did was in moral good standing with my God. So I will meet him in heaven, wow. Right? And this earth will pass. My family will be all right without me. This is God's will. And that's my opportunity to go see my God. So we talk about, you know, some of the orders above, or if I've ever been in this, you know, moral conundrum. Well, no, because those... Essentially, it all, you know, from the highest chain, right? So somebody could give me an unlawful order, and there's systems and processes in the military to make sure that that unlawful order doesn't get followed out. And if it does get received, that person on the bottom says, hey, this is something unlawful or unmoral, so I don't have to do it. Because why? Simple, again, I have a brain. Murder is murder. I don't want to murder people, right? So that... doesn't right. pass the sniff test when our country was going through all these times of mass hysteria. And it was like, the police is bad. The National Guard in Washington, D.C. is bad. And all this, it's like, you know who those are? Those are people. Those people don't want to be yes. involved with or take part in any of the stupid stuff that we're fearing, because those people have a brain. Those people have a basic level of education in the United States that is a lot higher than other regions of the world. So my faith was with those overwhelming majority of good people. You gotta, yes. any organization, right? You can't just say it's good. There's always going to be outliers. You take the top 10% and you say, you guys are anomaly. You take the bottom 10% and you say, those two are anomaly. And you look at what you got in the middle, that 80% and what they're doing. And I use that as a gauge to say, hey, man, are these good people? Is this a good organization? And what are the tendencies that they're most likely going to have? And then you could kind of rest a little bit easier understanding that.
Yeah. Well said. Mana, I want to kind of push back a little bit on what you said. You know, kind of this idea that, you know, folks from above say, you know, what we're doing is kind of right and just, and, you know, so we're just going to kind of press forward and kind of do it with a clear conscience. You know, according to the Watson Institute of at Brown University. Since 2001, there have been at least like almost 800,000 civilian casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan combined, you know, where there have only been a fraction of that, 100,000 or so deaths of enemy combatants, you know. So it's difficult for me to sort of, you know, comprehend the moral justification of war when there's a disproportional amount of civilian deaths versus enemies, you know. So I'd love to kind of see how do you reconcile that, and, you know, what does that say about the consequences of war?
Pretty good statistic, but what's your takeaway from this statistic? War is bad?
No, I think that war...
There's too many civilians, you know, that get killed during armed conflict. Absolutely, man. But so if you've got 100,000 enemy combatants, what are they going to... If they were still alive on this earth, then did they have the opportunity to do X, Y, and Z across those 800,000 that are innocents, right? So they have the opportunity to enslave, human traffic, to do whatever their will was amongst those people. So yeah, when you look at the numbers, you say, my God, this is horrible. But I would just say, what's the actual effect if we just let those populations go untouched, right? Without repercussion for their actions. And that's, again, simple. It sounds bad, man, and it sounds absolutely horrible. And it is, because at the end of the day, when people are dying, we have lost our ability to communicate with each other and come to find good reason, right? That's why we have armed conflict. Yeah. So that stat is bypassing all of that. It's just saying, in my opinion, war is bad. Innocent people die when we go to war. You are absolutely right. But we have to look at the nature of the warfare that has been conducted. We have to look at those people and their actions and what happens when they go undeterred, right? So again, there's no right or wrong. You got to look at that matrix and say, hey, is war now a solution in order to get the effect that we want? So that statistic, I'm sure those people are real smart, man, but I think we got to look at it more holistic.
Yeah.
My guess, Will, I want to let you respond, but my guess is that in nearly every armed conflict, that I don't know this, but my guess is civilian casualties may always be higher in some sense than armed combatant casualties, by the nature of warfare. I'm pretty sure that's the case in World War II, in most of the major wars. We could look that up, but my guess is civilian casualties were greater than military casualties in just about every one of those. So it might be one of those inevitable, not to sound cold hearted, but inevitable byproducts of armed conflict.
Yeah, I was going to say, the article in the study wasn't trying to reach some sort of conclusion. It was just pure stats that I drew out of there. And one of the conclusions that I came away with was, do we make going to war, or do we allow the decision making to go into an armed conflict too easy for politicians? Because I think if you were sitting sort of at the table when they're deliberating this, and someone said, we have to kill these 100,000, enemy combatants, but, we may end up killing 800,000 civilians. And obviously, hindsight's 20/20, right? Most everybody in the room would probably be like, that doesn't seem to make sense, So the 800,000 civilians is a consequence of killing the 100,000 enemy combatants. But, the people that made the decision to kind of, put us over there, it may be almost too easy for them, because they don't have to, they don't have to pull the trigger. It's folks like yourself and other, members of the armed services, and this kind of leads into, my next question a little bit, dealing with the AUMF, or the authorization for the use of military force. So it was something that was created back in 2001. It was re-updated in 2002. It's an act that Congress had a vote on to authorize military force against those who, had planned, authorized, committed, or aided the 9/11 attacks, or who harbored such organizations or persons in order to prevent any future acts of international terrorism against the United States. It's been used a lot, both in Bush, Obama, Trump era. I guess I'm curious on, what do you think about it? Do you think we make it too easy for a president to say, yeah, fly that drone, go over here, bomb these people, and we will just, deal with our civilian casualties and losses?
I don't think there's no easy rhyme or way to I guess, justify that, or show the necessity for it. I think a lot of people look at that and you're like, man, is there really a need for that one person to have all, you know, all that power, especially when that law was intended for the specific purpose of going after those 9/11 terrorists, as you stated, right? The only thing that I would say is that's why it is so important to select our leaders and make sure that we're selecting people on good moral ground, right? So again, how many more reasons do we need to look at a person and really think about the consequences of that vote that you're casting, right? So very important there to select the right person. From a purely defensive standpoint, to me, it's as simple as if you're in a street fight and somebody slaps you, you're not going to stop and deliberate what the heck is going on before you decide to either put your hands back up, throw another punch or whatever. So in a very simplistic Juan Mata Mongo viewpoint, it's, hey, we also want to think about the second and third order effects of hamstringing ourselves, making this huge deliberation process. Now we are giving up a tactical advantage in our ability to respond to any action or any threat against the United States.
Did you have a question, Josh?
No, go ahead.
So I'm wondering, like, what's sort of the mental or spiritual process by which, you know, a Green Beret or really any soldier kind of goes through to, you know, ready themselves for the eventuality of taking somebody's life, you know? And maybe you can describe, you know, your own sort of routine. Maybe it varies or differs from person to person, you know. I'd love to kind of hear, like, what's that process like?
I think the process, it's not your football players, hey man, I'm wearing my superstitious socks before I go out on the field, and I always put my left one on and then my right one. Like, while, you know, some soldiers could prepare for that before we go out to conduct an operation, I think the real answer is a lot further back, because we have a warrior culture. Right. So it comes from the minute that that person wants to step into our environment, they get inundated with an environment where to be a warrior is acceptable. To be a warrior is something sought after. Right. The most courageous acts are the most celebrated acts, and we award them with medals of honor, devices for valor on awards, and there's ceremonies, and it's an entire culture that leads that soldier to act a certain way in battle, right? So it starts, you know, way far left of bang, if you will. So all of that mental and spiritual whatever you want to call it, it starts very, very early.
Got it. That's interesting. It's almost like the goal probably of the army and the military is to make that person react in such a way that they don't have to deliberate with, you know, their circumstances in order to make a decision that could save their lives. So it's almost like if you prepare the foundation for the eventuality that they may have to take somebody's life, then they're going to be firmly planted when they have to pull the trigger or what have you, right?
Right. Not only that, but I'm a huge believer in training, and It's very simple, right? So we want a soldier to act in a certain manner when confronted with a situation. So we don't want them to deliberate whether they got to pull the trigger or not. We want the stimulus of somebody shooting at them. The response that we want to create is shoot back, right? Look through your sights, identify the threat. And so our training simulates that, and it gets spread over and over and over so that when you're in the act, you're not thinking, you are responding, right? So that you've made that now become instinct. So the challenge and the million-dollar thing is we want our first instincts to be the only appropriate action needed in order to mitigate that threat. So that's very hard, and it's...
So it's like...
Go ahead, Josh.
Yeah, it's hard, and it's... Yeah, it seems like... you don't rise to the occasion, you fall to the level of your training.
100%. And that's the old cliche, right? It's, you hear examples, and again, you got to take the 10s off. Top 10, go away. Bottom 10, right? So we got to look at the overwhelming majority of people do in these situations. And overwhelming majority of people don't have any other than an adrenal response, any other physical capability in order to conduct a certain thing. I'm not going to go from never being able to touch the rim on a basketball hoop to slamming like Shaquille O'Neal. It's just not reasonable for that to happen. So we shouldn't expect those exact same things in any situation, right?
That makes a lot of sense. What do you feel like is something that you would want the general public to understand, like the most important thing for them to understand about what you do, and, you know, and connecting that to what you do and what people like you do, which I'm thankful for, and I thank you for your service to our country. What do you want me, my family, those who are not in the military, those who don't do, what do you want us to understand about what you do and how that affects our lives?
So, thank you for the support. That's the best response I could come up with every time somebody says, thank you for your service. Thank you for your support. So, overall themes, right? So we're looking at your podcast and the March for Life, but what I would like the American society to know is, where is death in society now? So to me, it feels like there's the absence of killing in our society, which is part of the circle of life, right? So let's go back and watch The Lion King one more time, and we realize that death is a natural part of society. And I don't understand how it came to the fact that we don't see it anymore. It's not common. It's almost when we have a passing in society, we don't see the person go through those final acts. We don't. It's a very sheltered thing nowadays, where you could grow up your entire life and not see an animal slaughtered, but eat meat 3 times a day, right? So we have gotten very comfortable with the absence of killing. We are always going to have a warrior class, and we have to accept the fact that there are people that are still very comfortable with killing, and killing is an everyday part of life. So I'm not looking at, don't look at me like I'm weird for killing. I'm looking at you just as weird for being absent of death in your life, man. So that's what I want to tell America, is like, there's a stigma, right? And that PTS, like, hey, man, killing isn't natural. You had a kill on our behalf, and thank you for your support. But now you must be really messed up from all of the stuff that you did, right? Like, come here. And there's like a I've seen in my transition from the military into civilian life, it's almost like civilians want to coddle me and let me know, like, it's okay, right? Like, absolutely, every action is going to have a reaction, good, bad, or indifferent. If I was in a car wreck, I'd wear my seatbelt afterwards because I knew that that piece of equipment worked and saved my life. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with me going to Iraq and Afghanistan and all my fellow soldiers and killing and coming back to the United States and being okay with it and being comfortable. So I'm comfortable with it. I think I need the rest of the United States to be comfortable with that fact also, that people are going to die. Bad people, some bad people need to die because the acts that they were committing on this earth were evil and heinous, and us as a society were not going to stand for it. That person, while we try to debate and we try to do everything in order to ultimately see their end, that person was unwitting, right? That person didn't want to come to the negotiating table, so their ends came violently, unfortunately, and that's okay. That's okay, man. And that's, I guess, my parting message to both us in the service. Hey, man, it's okay to come back and be okay with the acts that you committed overseas. And American citizens, it's okay to send that soldier overseas because that's what they want to do. That's what we've lost, I think, a little bit as a culture. But unknowingly, we still like those things. We still like Marvel comic books, superheroes. We still like that person that's willing to stand right and fight for what's right. We are born and bred with those things. We just, when we see it in reality, it's something that's taboo.
Wow, that's something else. So on that happy note, you're the CEO of a company called Quiet Pro Tactical, right? What does your company do?
So our company right now focuses heavily on working with military and law enforcement. When we retired out and I retired into the environment that our country was in, it was like, how do I help my community get out of this mess? And one of the avenues that I saw was using my experience, right? My experience is very relative in today's society, and I want to work with everybody that holds a firearm, right? And has been entrusted by society to carry a firearm. I want to make that person as competent and as capable as humanly possible. And with that comes confidence that they don't even need that tool, and that tool might not be appropriate in every situation, right? So the more that I could train, educate others to really understand what that tool is given for, I want them to know everything about it and how to employ it, right? So that's what we really focus on with our work with law enforcement.
Wow, that's awesome. So like if our listeners wanted to reach out or connect with you or your company, like where can they go?
So we're on Facebook and Instagram, Quiet Pro Tactical, and then our website, quietprotactical.com. Just get on those platforms, shoot us a message, and then we will attempt to help you or your organization as much as we can.
Is there like a promo code you can give them for like 10% off?
So funny story. So customers are like, hey man, where's my 10% off? I'm like, brother, if you're only dealing with military and law enforcement, it's already 10% off. Like, I'm making the training as affordable as I can because I want you to have the tools in order to succeed. So it's not $9.99. It is the bare minimum of what I could charge in order to feed my family and for you to walk away with some life-saving skills.
That's awesome. Well, thank you, Mata. We just want to thank you for spending some time with us. It was always kind of fun. You know, I've known you for a long time, and have always appreciated and looked up to you, and just thought that the work you do is awesome. Like, you know, while I got out of the military, you know, after 4 years, you decided to go for it the long haul, which says a lot about your character, you know, and I'm always trying to get, like, you know, top secret information from you. But, you know, for anybody listening, he never tells me anything. You know, although I've got a suspicion that you had something to do with the death of Tupac, but we won't get into that here.
That's false. That is 100% false.
We'll see.
Me being a man Jerry's of good out. Moral character and 90s hip hop fan, no way.
Well, thank you again. Thank you to our listeners, and we will see you guys next week. All right, bye bye.